this week on Core Talk.
We've seen debris fields, but this one was different. It would remind you of a bowl of Lucky Charms, the brown, which would be your woody debris out there. And then here's all these little white pieces, so you know this one's different.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We're a team of professionals, biologists, engineers, real estate and administrative specialists, lawyers, and many other specialties, all working together to deliver engineering solutions that are vital to securing our nation, energizing our economy, and reducing disaster risks.
Safely,
on time,
and within budget.
This is Core Talk, the USAFE's Norfolk District podcast. From harbor port deepening and coastal storm risk management to environmental restoration and research and development, we exist to serve our community because we are a part of it.
SAONS.
SAONS.
SAONS. Let us try.
The storm hit Georgia, the Carolinas, Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, and it made its way through North Carolina and began to cause flooding in the New River and many other rivers. And one of the most impactful stories that I remember coming across was that of Linda and Carl McMurray. So what happened was, as the rivers began to flood, and maybe one of you guys can correct me, I don't remember exactly how high the river was in that area, but it started to go through people's homes or break parts of the homes off or take the homes completely away. And in the case of Mr. and Mrs. McMurray, the water went through their home and carried Mr. McMurray out of his home into the water, where he was forced to, you know, to save his own life, grab onto a tree and wait for up to 3 hours for help, not even knowing if anybody was going to come help, and also not knowing where his wife was or how she was, just holding on for dear life. And that's something that me personally, I've never had to imagine. Like, if that were me in that situation, like, wow, right? Like, I have no idea where my kids are, where my wife is. I don't know how I would be feeling holding on to a tree for 3 hours, hoping, you know, one more second, maybe somebody will be here one more second to help me out. It's incredible what the people of not just Southwest Virginia, but people everywhere in the southeastern region of the United States had to go through with the effects of Hurricane Helene. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Core Talk. I'm James Walker.
Now, Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser.
And today we bring you a very interesting and final episode of our season. We'll be discussing the collaborative response efforts of Hurricane Helene, which passed through and significantly impacted the southeastern region of the United States just last year. In short, we'll be discussing the response program priorities and procedures. We'll talk about the partnerships that made it a reality. And most importantly, we'll be discussing how it impacted the people. As we get started, let's go ahead and have everybody around the table introduce themselves.
Aaron Jones, Army Corps of Engineers, Baltimore District. Back home, I'm a contract specialist out here. I was technical assistant and a mission manager.
I'm Dave Dobbins. I'm a board of directors member of Friends of Clater Lake, 501(c) nonprofit. And I'm also the volunteer cleanup supervisor for our crew. We have a crew of from 6 to 4 people. So this was very personal for us.
I'm Roddy Havens, the park manager of Clater Lake State Park.
Good morning. I'm Ben Porter, emergency management specialist with the Norfolk District Army Corps of Engineers.
Thanks for joining us. And I know this is coming to an end here, but I just want to bring us back to the beginning a little bit and kind of the initial feelings and understanding of the situation that we were going through when we first got here. So I think it was the end of September. I was in just a regular meeting at the office, and I got a phone call from Robert, our emergency management chief, that the state had called and was asking for some assistance from the Corps of Engineers to help with some of the assessments that they were looking at to get a better understanding of the situation. They knew the local populace was getting overwhelmed. The regional coordinators from VDEM were getting overwhelmed, and the state was trying to understand what was going on in the situation. So we sat down with the state coordinator out of VDEM. We sat down with the FEMA FCO, or the federal coordinating officer, and we tried to understand what they were looking at in terms of the entire problem set in southwestern Virginia. After those discussions, we were able to come out to this area. We took a look at Damascus, and as you go into the town, you could just see all of the devastation that water flow that you discussed earlier had caused. And you could see the community working very diligently and very hard to clean up all of that debris and damage that was caused from the river flow. We tried to get a better understanding from the regional coordinator that was out there if there's any possibilities to assist. And then from there, we went out to Clater Lake, which is where we are today. And when I got there, I cannot even describe in words the amount of debris that I saw. You couldn't even see the water, you know, as we were looking at the outsides of the lake. Sitting down with Colonel Avichaw and Sean Tomich, you know, the state coordinator, there was opportunity for us to help, and it was really setting that understanding of how we could assist, and that's where we were in terms of kind of like setting the conditions for getting the Corps of Engineers involved.
I think it's very interesting how, you know, we sometimes can be, you know, in a bubble, in our own worlds. Somebody else not too far away can be experiencing suffering, and we could be completely oblivious and not have an idea of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
While you were in your meeting, I was actually on personal leave. I hadn't been paying attention to the news, so to be honest with you, I didn't even know it was a hurricane at this point. As is my job, I'm watching the news, I'm scrolling through social media, and I'm also seeing a little bit of confusion regarding, well, obviously there's some anxiety, but there's confusion regarding if, how, or when assistance is going to be provided to the people of this area, people that have been hurt or lost so much. They feel like they're just waiting and they don't have any answers. Today, we're going to unpack that process, that response process, and explain what happens at every level before relief becomes visible on the ground. What's happening before you can actually notice what's happening? So I'd like to start from the beginning. Soon as the local authorities knew, EMS and public safety were involved. Bang, I know that you don't work for the state, but you work with the state. Could you please kind of paint a picture for us of what that looked like? The initial, from the beginning up until the point when you say it starts to get involved, what does that look like?
Yeah, so emergency response always starts from the local level with first responders, and that's where the initial needs are identified. If local resources are not sufficient to support the needs of the impacted community, then that extra support is requested from the state, and those requests go to the Emergency Operations Center in the state capital of Richmond. And as the reports and requests were coming in from the communities, it quickly became clear that federal support would likely be needed. And soon after, the governor requested a major disaster declaration, which enables the coordination for the federal support that Colonel Funkhauser mentioned earlier to start flowing. And then when a disaster is declared by the president, FEMA is the lead federal agency under the National Response Framework. Within that framework, Army Corps of Engineers is the lead agency for what we call ESF3, Emergency Support Function 3. And that's Public Works and Engineering. And once a state requests federal assistance, FEMA will embed with the state and assess the needs and start to issue mission assignments to their federal partners. At the beginning of a response, FEMA mission assignments to USACE, to Army Corps, is for regional activation, which allows for us to send our experts to join the planning and response teams in the State Emergency Operations Center, which helps to identify where best our resources could support in order to free up some of the state's resources so that they can continue meeting the immediate needs of the impacted communities. And to narrow discussion a little bit to this mission at Clater Lake, the response leaders that were gathered in the Emergency Operations Center in Richmond, they created a debris task force. And this is the group that's responsible for identifying the scope of the mission that would be tasked to a federal partner like Army Corps of Engineers. It was decided by the task force that FEMA would issue Army Corps of Engineers a mission assignment for waterborne debris, initially for Clater Lake, due to the sheer scale of debris in Clater Lake. As part of the Army Corps' planning efforts, we have pre-scripted missions that we have coordinated with FEMA, and one of those missions is debris removal and clearance. These prescripted missions have trained planning and response teams, PRTs, that are ready to deploy and manage these missions. We're fortunate that our closest sister district, Baltimore, has a debris PRT who have supported this since we received the mission from FEMA.
So Army Corps of Engineers is the contracting avenue and overseer of the work to be contracted. Just as we have PRTs ready to perform planning and oversight, we also have advanced contracting initiatives. That way we can issue large contracts in days or weeks compared to months and years like you'd see with non-emergency contracting. Shortly after we received our mission assignment from FEMA for the debris removal, we issued a contract and the contractor was able to mobilize within weeks.
So I have a question. Sorry to interrupt.
No, absolutely.
So the amount of time going back to, you know, people outside of their destroyed homes or now without a home, wondering if and when assistance want to come, the amount of time it takes from, you know, the hurricane passing through an area to, you know, the ball gaining some momentum and you start to see people on the ground moving and providing relief, that depends highly upon several different factors, right? And the number of people involved from the local level to even, I can't even remember how many people we had involved in USAID. It was over 300, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Like all of these hands are in the pot and these processes take time. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, so the federal agencies to get involved, you know, you need that declaration from the governor, which that happened pre-storm. You know, as the storm was coming up and the severity of it was realized, that happened, I believe it was the Friday before the storm hit. And that frees up the state to just like the federal agencies need a major disaster declaration from the president before we can get involved to start assisting the states. And most importantly, a request from the state for that support. The state needs to issue a state of emergency as well so that the communities, the counties and the cities below can also request support and the state can begin distributing their resources as they need to. So as far as timing goes, it all depends on what aspect of the response you're talking about. So pre-storm, there were already requests coming in to pre-stage assets around the state, whether it be communications caches, damage assessors, things like that. So I would say for the state resources, it was happening prior to what we'd say is landfall. This one came from inland. So, you know, I would say probably about 48 hours, we were already starting that coordination within the state. And we're just because we are not actively working for the state, we are constantly communicating with the state. So even in the calls pre-storm, pre-declaration, you know, the Emergency Operations Center was holding meetings and we were all getting aligned on what support may be requested. That way we're always ahead of the request for that assistance. So, right. You know, we're kind of monitoring, anticipating, and coordinating with the state to make sure that we're available to meet the needs. And it kind of goes to a story I heard from Aaron, the mission manager, in his role as technical assistance subject matter expert. He was on the ground just a couple days after the presidential declaration was approved, and FEMA was embedded in the EOC. So I would say within 4 days of the governor declaring an emergency for the state, Army Corps of Engineers was already actively involved with the response efforts.
So kind of in the same fashion that Colonel Funkhauser did, can you kind of explain the whole, so there I was, as far as how you personally got involved into the recovery efforts?
Yeah, absolutely. So we really started really tuning into the response for this storm midweek prior to what I'll say is landfall. And we were tied in with the meetings at the Virginia EOC. And we weren't really expecting much of it because it was tracking a little further west. The impacts to our state, it was about as far west as you could get in Virginia. So we weren't anticipating a huge impact. But as the storm developed through the weekend, we noticed that, you know, it was significantly impacting the western part of our state. And so coordination really started to spin up. And I remember Monday morning when we got into the office and we were starting to see some of the initial reports of damage from that region. We knew that that there was going to be there was likely going to be some assistance needed from the federal government. So Monday morning following the storm, Colonel Avichal, Colonel Funkhauser, and our emergency manager for Norfolk District, Robert Andrezani, they headed right to the Emergency Operations Center to meet with the state coordinating officer. And more than anything else, the meeting was really to ensure that there was alignment among the highest levels of our leadership and the state leadership. One story that really sticks with me from that Monday morning meeting was when Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser, Colonel Avichal, and Robert Angrisani walked into the executive meeting room to meet with the state coordinator, Sean Tomich. He was just finishing a call with Governor Youngkin, and the state coordinator turned his camera to the group of them and told the governor, "It's all going to be okay. The Corps is here. Everything's going to be okay." So that was a testament to the relationship that we have. I mean, Blue Skies, we're constantly coordinating with Virginia Department of Emergency Management. That's our state. So we're embedded with them and we're making relationships that make a friend before you need a friend. Following that meeting with the state coordinating officer, Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser and Robert immediately left from the state EOC and traveled to the highest impacted areas. That'd be Damascus, Clater Lake, and they captured some of the devastation and the needs within Southwest Virginia. That way they could tell that story to USAIS leadership. At the time, so many resources were being sent to every state in Helene's path that we definitely wanted our leaders to know that Virginia also needed our support. In the following days and weeks, Colonel Avichal was in lockstep with SCO. I think he spent more time down in Southwest Virginia than he did back at the district for those few weeks. And he met with the state coordinating officer, the FEMA coordinating officer, and the governor on quite a few occasions. And that senior engagement was foundational to our support for the Commonwealth.
Yeah, I know. Robert always addresses it. He says, "Have a friend before you need a friend, or make a friend before you need a friend." And I think we've done that very well from an emergency management standpoint of knowing all the people across the regions, knowing the folks that work in the VDEM headquarters out of Richmond. But you're spot on. The ability for Colonel Avichal, Sean, Tim File over at FEMA, their ability to quickly tie in, understand the problem set that was out here, going able to see the sites, you know, taking you out there to help provide that public affairs coverage on it as well. So we're sharing what's going on and helping share the facts of the story was very beneficial. What I would also say is, you know, as we were getting here, we are working through a lot of problem sets, and it's just, it'd be good to kind of see some of the logistical challenges and how your guys' initial actions from Focal were focused on at the lake. If you'd share some of those, Dave.
It was obvious to us because of the heavy rain that trouble was coming. So our crew was pumping out boats, pulled our John boat before it sunk and so forth, because we got an enormous amount of rain. We started seeing debris come down. Most of the debris was coming down from the southern end of the lake, above the Lomans Ferry Bridge. And it was an enormous amount of debris. So I called our crew foreman for Friends of Clater Lake. He was out of town. The assistant foreman and one of the other gentlemen came in and used our push boat to go out to try to snag the recover boats, jet skis, some jet skis upside down, and pull them to shore, time off. Same thing with docks, because we need to protect the dam. The concern, they have a barrier. There's a barrier that just a few years ago, Appalachia replaced with a new barrier, and I received a call from Appalachia Power, who operates and controls the dam, that they were concerned. So we were with the two men on the push boat, but we were just grabbing anything we could, tie it off safely, go back and get more. And then we started seeing the propane tanks. And so the next day, that was on Saturday, September 28th, the foreman came back from his trip, and we had a crew with our large barge is 20 feet wide by 52 feet long, and we have an excavator that's on that barge, to so we were able to to sort of break through the debris field to get the propane tanks. And we take those to the Virginia Department of Emergency Management hazmat team, who had set up at the state park here to take care of the hazardous material. So the first real push was hazardous material, boats, anything we could get before they went further downstream towards the dam. And over time, that was on Saturday, the crew worked through the week and through the following weekend. So we were the only, and we realized there was no way, but the amount of debris we saw, you know, as Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser said, it was all the way across. The lake was totally covered pretty quickly from the debris field coming downstream. And we worked primarily with the hazmat team taking the propane tanks. The largest was 250 gallons, and there were a number of 200-gallon propane tanks, 100-gallon propane tanks, and a lot of the smaller tanks that you would use for a grill. And then also gas tanks from boats that were sunk or flipped that were extremely hazardous. The hazmat coordinator that I worked with said, you know, Dave, if a boat hits one of those things with the prop, you know, you could have an explosion. It was very dangerous. So that was our heavy concentration again, retrieving personal property, even docks that we could tie to shore during that time. I received a call from Appalachia Power. They had alerted me that there were some large trees with limbs still on them in the flow of the lake, and that would be like a battering ram hitting their protected barrier at the dam. So we sent the crew down there with the excavator, and we were able to pull those out. Yeah, that was a heavy concentration on trying to protect the dam. And from there, we worked, we kept working. Thank goodness for VDEM and the Corps of Engineers for coming, because we could tell that as hard as we worked with our equipment, we would never be able to clean the place up. And so from there we've continued to work until we finally hit some underwater debris that caused a hole in our large barge on the front brake section. And so on the 21st of November, you know, we were not able to be on the water. But by then, most of that had been taken care of. And of course, the Corps, I forgot what date in October where they actually were able to get on the water. I know you all mobilized and were getting equipment here. Tractor trailers were coming, barge sections and push boats, and pretty much took over the state park, Brody. But thank goodness that they were able to set up and get started.
So, Brody, as a park ranger, would you be able to share your perspective? What activities you saw? What needs did you see? What were some of the initial concerns?
There was, you've got all the forecast of heavy rain and winds moving into the area. Appalachian Power had made their notifications, hey, we're going to drop the lake 3 feet to help absorb some of that overflow of rainfall. And that was kind of the week leading up to, you know, all the preparations of getting saws ready, chainsaws ready, everything fueled, generators ready in case there's a power outage.
Right.
And so, you know, during the storm, we had heavy rain, a little bit of wind. I think the winds had died down pretty good by the time they got to us. So we just had a few limbs and one big tree. That's all we had to clean up during the day. So I'm thinking, okay, we've fared fairly decently through this storm. And 3 o'clock that morning, AEP notified of their other protocols. So the two dams above
Clater here is Buck and Bilsby Dam.
I'm sorry, is there AP or
AUP, Appalachian Power? Yes. And they were notifying, hey, we're at the levels where we're going to have to increase flows into the lake and could potentially, you know, create flooding downstream, which would also include the areas of Radford and downstream from there. So, you know, that 3 o'clock in the morning, you're thinking, okay, so the water's coming. We know there's going to be some flooding. And the next morning, I got up before daylight and was kind of standing on the point overlooking the lake. And you could see as the sun come up, you know, the debris field, some of it. But as the light increased, here are a lot more items that you would normally see. I've been here 23 years, and we've seen debris fields through different floods along the way. But this one was different. It would remind you of a bowl of Lucky Charms. So you've got the brand or the brown, which would be your woody debris out there. And then here's all these little white pieces, which come to find out are propane tanks. And then you've got red, which would be gas tanks and things like that. And then you've got pontoon boats, whole docks, pieces of boathouses. So obviously, you know, this one's different. So up above the lake, you know, they've had some pretty good devastation up that way. Kind of transition into one other thing I noticed was the rate at which the debris was moving downstream. Typically on the lake, there's very little movement. You've got, you know, the wind that pushes things around, but realistically, you don't see a river flow. It was moving. I mean, it had, you could count 15, 20 seconds in a pontoon boat that come into view would be out of view very quickly. So I immediately came down to the launch ramp area to see how many boaters were out on the water using our ramp, and thinking, okay, how are they going to get off of the water through that debris field? And at that time, it was on the far side of the lake. It hadn't quite reached all the way across yet, but it was a significant, probably 100-yard, 150-yard wide swath of debris moving at a fairly good clip. So those fishermen that were out there said, yeah, I'm done for the day, and they decided to come out and put their boats back on the trailer. But while standing at the ramp, there was actually a visible flow that you could see at the ramp, and we never see that. So if you can imagine the lake going from 3 feet down to almost a foot high in a matter of hours. So I would assume, I wasn't up all night, but I would assume that time I went to bed, it was still at 3 feet. And that morning at sunrise, you know, it was already coming up and actually above normal pool, which I think it was about a foot above normal here that morning. So the launch ramp typically does not have any water at all on the decking boards. And it was, you could barely walk on the decking boards without getting your feet wet. It had come up that much. As the day progressed, you know, those thoughts run through your mind. It's a thousand things to think of. Okay, the lake also serves as a water source. We've got different types of debris in here. You know, what is that going to do downstream? As Dave mentioned, you know, you've got all that debris potential hitting the dam. What's that going to cause? So, you know, we had some phone calls with the emergency management coordinator here in the county, Brad Wright, and he was busy, obviously, in the other areas of the county with all the emergency management coordination going on there for notifying and doing kind of search and rescue operations, and then making sure that those folks that they had notified to evacuate were out of there. And, you know, life is number one priority in those instances. But later that evening, they cleared those areas and were able to make it to the park. Him and the local fire chief for New Bern Fire Department, and I looked at the picnic area, and at that time the flow had stopped and the debris had become more the mercy of the wind. So it was kind of stacking up and pushing over to our side, and all of the coves along the left side of the lake, it was just covered with debris. You couldn't get in and out from the launch ramps or anything like that. So We organized, you know, hazardous materials operations to be set up. BDM came in. They came in the next morning, and we started working through, okay, how do we get boats out there? How do we get this? One, you don't know what you have out there. Two, where do we start putting these types of hazardous materials as it comes off? So they coordinated with EPA. They were quick to show up and started removing the propane tanks. There were a few home fuel tanks out there that had to be removed. Luckily, it was contained. We were able to boom around those diesel tanks and keep it contained in those areas. So I think the environmental impacts were lessened by those efforts. But, you know, Friends of Clutter Lake were out there. Department of Wildlife Resources, the day of, our local guys were in Damascus helping doing search and rescue operations down there. And then the following days, they were on the water trying to help contain those tanks and hazardous materials and removing those. Coast Guard Auxiliary here in the county for the lake, they were also out there, and whatever boats we could get, which began another challenge. You're trying to work your way through a sea of debris with propellers. Pulaski County brought their jet boat, which would normally run the river for swift water rescue operations. We figured that would be a little bit better. Now, with the fine debris, it was sucking up into the impellers, and they were constantly having to clean it out. So it quickly, okay, we're going to restore some props, but this is the only way. We need some different boats and things like that to even navigate through the field. So that Monday, Tuesday time frame, we started seeing other folks, and I think you all even showed up even that first Monday and Tuesday, and it was trying to show folks how big the debris field is. And realistically, drones were the best way to tell, okay, where are things, items of interest. And early on, Pulaski County Sheriff's Office sent out their drone teams. Every morning we would look and see where things have migrated to and where to try to concentrate efforts for that particular day. And it would change. That morning it would be on one side of the lake. By that afternoon or midday, it would have shifted completely to the other side. So early on, we knew we needed some help. And I think they worked BDM through those channels to get you all on site. And, you know, here come the equipment and a lot of extra, you know, I've heard many statements from folks that were staying on the shore. It's going to take years to clean this up. So, well, we've got help coming, and I think it'll go pretty quickly once it's mobilized. So just the sheer number of pieces of equipment and personnel and things like that was all striking to see the place fill up with that type of operation. And in the back of your mind, you're still, how do we maintain access to the lake for homeowners? You know, winter's right around the corner. Boats are going to have to come out. And at that point, there was no thoroughfare really to be able to get on the lower end of the lake anyway to get through the water safely. So those quick efforts to be able to start removing debris was spot on and much appreciated. And I think the local community will agree that we're very, very thankful that you all came on as soon as you did and were able to remove the amount of debris that has been removed from the lake over the last several months. So
to add on to what Brody's just discussed is what he saw. Fortunately, our Board of Supervisor Chair, Laura Walters, got in touch with our local representatives and also the governor. And the governor came down with folks with VDM and toured. This was when, like 2 days after the storm. And that really, I think, made it real clear to him. And that really expedited, I think, working with you all to get you here. Also, once the Corps was here with the contractor, and were able to clean. What we were doing was trying to keep the launch ramps clean. So people wanted to get their boats out. And so we cleaned the Department of Wildlife Resources launch ramps, the DeHaven launch ramps, trying to help. And they were putting out notices to encourage people to get their boats out, which made it a whole lot easier to clean up. So that was really our concentration. Even after you had your contractors here, and boy, we were sure glad to see them. Then our mission was to keep the ramps clean, so people could clean up, so the folks could get their boats out, and also, getting the woody debris. We had, I think 30 cubic yard roll-off loads of wood debris, just doing that part of the mission. And I know the Corps got much, much more out, but we were fortunate to be able to work alongside with the Corps, staying out of their way and with their large equipment. It was a really good coordination between the Corps folks. And then once, as I mentioned, we had a hole in our barge, so that ended our ability to take special requests from folks. But I was able to contact the Corps directly, and they were really responsive in taking care of those special requests. Sometimes people have found hazardous materials that they had along their property, as well as different kinds of debris, and we couldn't go to remove those. But the commander for the Corps, Valentin Torres, was very helpful in a number of those cases. So it was really a very smooth transition. I know initially the thought was to just close the lake completely, but that was really going to jeopardize. Once the lake was clean enough, there were still people that wanted to fish. But the big thing was being able to recover their boats and get those out for the season. And because it was time for winterization, and they had, particularly those with inboard boats, that had to get them out. But I think the impact on this on the economy for Pulaski County in this region was greatly potentially challenged because of the debris. So that's why it was so important for the Corps to be here and be able to complete their mission, which they have done an incredibly good job. Appreciate both it. The above surface and the subsurface material that was removed to keep our ramps and park areas clean.
I'm listening to your guys' stories, and I often refer back to some of the military terminology because it's really like ingrained in my brain over the last 15 plus years. I hear the fog of war. There's a lot of unknowns from the storm, from your guys' stories that you're telling, and it took a while for the communication between all the different entities that were dealing with these situations, whether it was the community or the emergency management teams, right, or Focal or the state park rangers or the Corps or FEMA, right? Like, everyone's trying to build their running estimates and understand the situation that's occurred in Southwest Virginia.
As it's evolving,
right? And it's continuing to grow, it's developing, and everyone's just trying to get all this information and data to try to make informed decisions on how we want to support different aspects of the situation. And I find it fascinating by how well everyone communicated with each other, how fast information was shared. You know, we're talking about the speed that the the Corps and our team was getting down here to help support that, how fast you guys were on site starting to remove things to protect your key infrastructure, how fast you guys are communicating and getting, you know, at all costs, despite damage to your own equipment. You guys are, you know, the importance of why some of these things have to come off of the water, because it has much greater impacts to the entire population that's living out here. And I think that's really just fascinating to see the community doing that and all the different entities working so fast and so efficient to help accomplish that. And it gets us to where we start executing work, right? And it took an entire team to be able to do that. So I know we've talked about the many different aspects of building the assessments, of understanding the problem sets all across southwestern Virginia. And today we're here at Clater Lake. This is one of the main problem sets that we've been working on since, you know, end of September, early October. And, you know, we're talking about the speed and the efficiency of how fast we got here. And Aaron, you're one of the first members to get on site here and support that kind of initial onset of getting our folks and contractors on board and starting to get the work done.
Yeah, quantifying the debris.
Yeah. Can you kind of help explain how you guys went through that process of quantifying the debris, how we went through removing all that surface and submerged debris, and then, you know, maybe some of the challenges that you guys were working through?
I was mobilized with a team of four, or including myself, a team of four, as technical assistants. And basically, our job was to come down and try to assess debris, damage, areas. And it became very clear very quickly that Clater Lake was going to be a mission. So initially, we were focused on right-of-way debris. But within 2 days, we came down here to the state park, met Brody, and he got our team lead, technical assistance team lead, on a boat. And after that, it was within 2 days, we had determined that there was about 1,500 plus acres of impacted area, you know, observed. So, I mean, there could have been more, but, you know, we didn't go past the bridge initially.
And that's just surface debris.
That's just surface debris, yeah. About 2 days after that, Brody took myself and two others out on the boat again, and just observed debris, you know, trying to use a hunting app, you know, to map out, you know, the square footage. We would go around a debris pile. We put points on where we were located, and then it would give us an acreage. And just doing that, we came up with about 200 acres. And that's just observed again, you know, can't go into every single cove.
Yeah.
And that was from Brody, what's the bridge?
Lighthouse Bridge.
Yeah. Lighthouse Bridge all the way down to the dam. And that was our initial estimate, about 200 acres of observed debris. After that, things started mobilizing. We got, you know, a PRT down here. We were starting to write the contract, which is the ACI contract. We have ECC, which is the contractor on that. They were out here. They were doing their own estimates. We started thinking through the process of how this debris was going to get off the water. Obviously, Focal was very, you know, helpful with that, especially since they have barges and they have a technique and it's been working. I remember contacting you when we started and being like, what kind of excavator do you have? What kind of barge do you have? And realizing that we needed to scale that up. And that was then communicated to the contracting team and the contractor, and they developed a plan on how they were going to execute this. The focus was obviously keeping that dam open and removing any haz waste and white goods. You know, obviously this is drinking water, that's a priority as well. But also the recreation, you know, the local economy.
Safety.
Yeah, safety, the park, you know. So those were our initial thoughts. I was here for 2 weeks in the beginning. But I know the background. I was tracking the entire time, as I knew I was going to come back in as a mission manager later on. So for the actual estimates of debris removed, we have about 30,000 cubic yards. We didn't do it in acres. but 30,000 cubic yards, 10,000 tons.
We were doing some math. What was the put it in perspective.
I think that we saw that it equated to what would be 14 football fields covered of worth of debris.
Yeah, that seems about right.
Or I think also 8 city blocks is what it was.
It's crazy when you put it in a different perspective, especially for the folks that, like, I just hear a number, I'm like, okay, that sounds like a lot. But when you see, like, yeah, I know a football field, right? And if you're covering 14 of those, that's a pretty good amount of debris. And
not just covered, but a foot high, too. Just keep that in mind. So.
Yeah, and logistically, this was difficult. I mean, as Brody had said, this debris was moving. You know, it would move with the wind. It would move when they would release the dam. Obviously, this is supplying power, so you can't not release it. So it was logistically difficult, and I think, the drones were a huge part of that.
And again, that's just surface debris.
That's just surface debris, yeah.
Right.
And
as time went on, first boat ride, there was a lot more debris visible on the surface that the next trip may not be there because, with the different types of debris, some of them were still live trees that were more moisture laden, so they would sink faster, and then you had the drier debris that stayed on the surface. And debris would feel, not only with it shifting, it also was sinking. So some of the debris were live trees when they came down, and that weight would allow them to sink. And then the lighter debris would float on the surface. And as they crunched in tighter and tighter and become more compacted, you scratch the surface off and up would float something else out from underneath it. So it depended on which way the wind shifted and how compacted that debris field was would change your estimation almost hourly sometimes. So it was very difficult in that aspect.
Yeah, and I think that brings us to another point. Part of this mission was, how quickly can we get it done? Because that debris would sink, and once it sunk, it would become even more difficult to recover or remove, depending on how deep it was. Obviously, this lake goes pretty deep, but a lot of the debris would sit on shore, which is less than 10 feet, in some places for 30, 40 feet out, 50 feet out. We had to make sure that we were moving quick enough so that we didn't have a larger problem on our hands. Basically, how they would remove the debris they would corral it, pull it in deeper water, and then an excavator would go in and grab it from that corralled area. Basically, they'd use a boom, kind of like if you see the swim area, right, at the state park, it's just a floating rope.
Right.
And so they would just pull it in and then pick it up. But that becomes much, much more difficult when it sinks to the bottom and gets stuck in the mud, which was our second task order for this, was to remove that submerged debris that had sunk.
In the end, how much submerged debris did we end up removing?
It was much less. I mean, that's based on how we were removing it. Some of it became fish habitat,
mm-hmm.
And some of it is removed from the actual lake. Our main goal is to try to create fish habitat, so we wanted to leave as much of that debris in deeper water as possible.
Yeah.
Anything that was more than 10 feet in depth. But we ended up, I think it was with around 600 cubic yards after the submerged debris. That was very localized, right? We had specific areas, which was D Haven, swim area, to make sure the public, could access that safely without any snags or any debris that would pose a hazard. The public boat ramps, so Dublin boat ramp, D Haven boat ramp, Clater Lakes State Park boat ramp, and then some other local swim areas as well.
Ben, I wanted to ask you, so everything that Aaron was just explaining as far as the excavators and getting the debris out of water, I understand that there were some initial challenges getting all of the resources needed to even get the ball rolling on that. Can you speak to that? Like, what were some of the challenges that
the Tim faced.
Right. So, yeah, we obviously were not the only state impacted by Hurricane Helene. So as the response to Helene was taking shape, you know, there were missions all the way down the East Coast, inland from the impacts of Helene. And so some of the equipment that we needed to get the operation started, I mean, it was coming as far away as Louisiana, barges and excavators and stuff like that. So, and think about the track that equipment has to take. It's coming right through those impacted areas. And as everybody's seen on the news, you know, that's not an easy trip, especially in the early days of the response. So those were definitely some of the challenges trying to get the right equipment, enough equipment on site to get the ball rolling to start making an impact on the debris removal mission here at Clater Lake. Some of the biggest lessons learned, the relationships that we made during Green Skies, like, I mean, I can't stress it enough. I know I've already talked about it before and Colonel Funkhauser mentioned it at the beginning, make a friend before you need a friend. So, as emergency, managers and specialists, we're not sitting around waiting for an emergency to happen. We're constantly planning and we're constantly making those connections with the local leaders and the local emergency managers. That way, when things like this happen, we know who to call. We know, you know, where to get the information we need. And that goes all the way up to Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser and Colonel Avichal. And they, you know, our mission for Army Corps of Engineers, and I can't overstate the importance of the mission that we have to support the citizens of the United States. But our main mission when a state is impacted, and that's any district, any emergency management outfit across the Corps, is to lessen the suffering of our fellow citizens. You know, that becomes our main mission. So the engagement by Colonel Avichal, Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser, you know, to pull them away from their day-to-day missions, I mean, it speaks volumes. That effort was crucial in the beginning phases of this to make sure that we had all of the authority and resources at their disposal available for the state and Commonwealth to try to get out of this situation.
Where else is still ongoing as far as you say support is concerned?
As these rivers receded, you know, a lot of debris was left on the shorelines, and that's, you know, even in the far reaches, in the valleys and in the hollers upstream, where that debris is still deposited. And so the state was concerned with, okay, we've got another high water event. How is that going to impact bridges, bridge abutments, and infrastructure downstream should that high water event occur? So we were able to dispatch and deploy a structural engineer to come and help with some of those assessments. That's another mission. We've got an archaeologist that's on site to help. I understand any cultural, historical significance to some of the areas that have been impacted. We've got a JFO in Bristol where FEMA is still processing individual assistance applications. And one of our missions, we have a hired annuitant cadre that we've got about 15 of them down range helping to support process those applications to get individual assistance to the impacted communities. So yeah, absolutely. Just because this mission has ended at Clater Lake, we're still actively working in other parts of the state as well, support FEMA and the Commonwealth.
Yeah. So I think I'll follow on the theme of Ben over here. Make a friend before you need a friend. Well, I mean, when I came on as technical assistance, this job in the first few days was getting points of contacts. Brody being our main point of contact, who then put us in touch with Focal. Without you guys, this mission would not have started as smoothly, and we wouldn't have as good of an idea of what we were dealing with without you. I mean, getting on the water was the first step, and then talking to Focal was definitely the second. So I think, you know, points of contact, lessons learned. I mean, it's important to go out and find the individuals that know more than you and can provide you the information. You know, we're here for 2 days, have never been to Clater Lake. I just can't imagine how we would have developed an idea or understand what the scope of this was going to be without you guys. I appreciate that.
Yeah, a key takeaway for me was the support. So the our emergency management office, we're three specialists down there, and you know the scale and the size of the operation that we had to undertake. It really was a team effort, and I think a big takeaway was realizing the support we had, not just from every section. I mean, it touched every section: contracting, real estate, resource management, logistics. Every section of our team. It took everybody, and we had that support. And I think that was crucial to the successful completion. And we were glad to have it. Absolutely. So
for key takeaways for me, one, the ability to think outside the box or surround yourself with people who can think outside the box was very critical in the beginning of trying to mobilize. And you don't know what you need until you need it, kind of thing. And so it was very critical with the local partners and them reaching out and asking for help in the very early stages of it. And then the communication, as mentioned earlier, that was crucial and very key from the beginning. And the stakeholders meeting, you know, working with us as local partners with you all and listening to the voices of those here was spot on. And I really appreciate those efforts put in for that stakeholder meeting to continue and to allow that information to flow freely back and forth. So it was very crucial to have that in place. So
I want to particularly give thanks to Laura Walters, the chairman of our County Board of Supervisors, who immediately, she's also on the board of directors for Friends of Clater Lake. So she knew exactly what to do, and she went straight to Brad Wright, who's our county emergency management coordinator. From there, he went to Justin Hagee, who's the local VDM representative. And the reaction was very, very quick. She also contacted our local state delegate, our local state senator. They got on the horn with the governor, and then the governor's response was immediate. So he was here in the boat with one of the Department of Wildlife the resource group getting a tour, and he was amazed to see what we were trying to do with our equipment, and he could take a look. I mean, he didn't have to be a rocket scientist to see what we were getting out of the lake, but yet looking at the acres of what lay ahead to be removed. So the quick reaction on the local level, and I'm sure this is probably true in Bristol or Damascus as well, is extremely important. And then with the cooperation from the Corps of Engineers, we will be whole again. Lieutenant Colonel Funkhauser, we look forward for you to come back.
Thank you.
And see a clean Clater Lake. Thank you very much.
For sure. I'm thinking through all the stories that we've been talking about today and really over the last couple of months that we've been working on this mission. And I continue to believe and I continue to stress that the Corps of Engineers is a people business. Like, we're people helping people. And I think this mission set proves that.
100%.
It continues to reiterate that. Like, we're here for the communities because we live in these communities. Like, I didn't know about Clater Lake until this mission set.
Me neither.
I sure as heck want to take my family out here.
Me too.
And visit in the springtime when it's nice. So I look forward to seeing you guys again, you know, when I can bring my family out here. But I would just say, it is about the people on this team. We have a really great organization. We've worked with a lot of great organizations on this mission, and I think we've kind of dived into that during the discussion today. So really, I just want to thank you, Dave. Thank you, Brody, for being part of this conversation. Thank you to all our VDEM partners that have assisted with this, and our FEMA partners that have assisted, all the ESF3 and PRT cadre, that all of y'all were critical to supporting this mission set. We couldn't have done it as a district without you guys. And I really just can't thank you enough. Colonel Avichaw and I just thank you for helping us and work to this mission set. And I'll leave it with that.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for tuning in to the Core Talk podcast. Please like, share, and subscribe if you've enjoyed this conversation and found the information to be interesting or useful. Your feedback matters. Remember to comment with any ideas or questions you may have regarding U.S. Army Corps of Engineers projects within your community. Episodes come out the first Wednesday of every month. Until next time.